Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're going to be looking at a pretty complex and honestly kind of unsettling chapter in the history of pain management in the U.S.
Yeah, it's a story that I think really gets to the heart of some important questions about how we as a society, you know, approach pain, addiction, and the role of law enforcement in healthcare.
You bet. So you've provided us with some excerpts from a Cato Institute policy analysis called Treating Doctors as Drug Dealers: The DEA's War on Prescription Painkillers.
Right.
And this analysis was published back in 2005, and it really dives deep into how the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, shifted its focus from illegal street drugs to prescription painkillers.
Mm-hmm.
So for this deep dive, we're going to unpack what that shift looked like and what impact it had on both doctors and patients.
It's a fascinating story, and one that I think will leave you with a lot to ponder.
Absolutely. So let's start by setting the scene. The Cato analysis paints a pretty stark picture of the chronic pain crisis in America. Millions of Americans suffer from chronic pain. And it's not just a personal struggle. It has massive societal and economic costs.
Absolutely. The source points out that in 1995 alone, untreated pain cost American businesses over $100 billion.
Wow.
That's not just about healthcare expenses. It's about lost productivity, disability, and the overall impact on the workforce.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling. And despite the scale of this problem, there's a severe shortage of doctors who specialize in pain management. I mean, why is that?
Well, for one thing, pain management is a relatively new field, and there's always been a certain stigma associated with narcotics. Many doctors are hesitant to prescribe them, fearing the potential for addiction or legal repercussions.
So millions are suffering, effective treatments exist, but there aren't enough doctors willing to or maybe even able to provide them. It's a real catch-22.
Exactly. And this is where opioid therapy comes into the picture.
Mm.
In the 1980s, doctors started advocating for the use of opioids to treat non-terminal chronic pain.
It's interesting.
They'd seen the benefits of opioids for, you know, terminally ill cancer patients and believed they could help a wider range of people.
Hmm. I imagine there was some pushback against that idea.
Oh, absolutely. Opioids were often compared to morphine and associated with death or addiction. There was a lot of fear and misinformation surrounding their use. But despite the resistance, opioid therapy started gaining traction, and the sales of prescription painkillers skyrocketed in the 90s.
Okay. So we've got this chronic pain crisis, a limited number of doctors specializing in pain management, and the rise of opioid therapy, albeit controversial.
Right.
And then, as the source points out, the DEA enters the picture and things start to change.
Yeah. The DEA was facing increasing pressure to show results in the war on drugs, and they needed a new front. Prescription painkillers, especially OxyContin, a long-acting opioid that became very popular, presented a new target.
Okay, so instead of going after illegal drug operations, they shifted their focus to doctors prescribing legal, regulated medications. I guess it makes sense from a strategic standpoint. It seems a lot easier to track and control, but was it the right move? Well, that's the question, isn't it? The source argues that this shift had some serious unintended consequences. The DEA launched the OxyContin Action Plan in 2001, and as part of that plan, they started comparing OxyContin to cocaine and heroin, which really fueled public fear.
And what's interesting here is that the source claims the DEA was using flawed data to justify this crackdown on OxyContin. They were misclassifying deaths related to the drug and even exaggerating the risk of death.
That's a crucial point. They would classify deaths as OxyContin-related simply because a pill was found in the deceased's system even if other drugs were present or if the death wasn't actually caused by OxyContin. It created this perception that the drug was far more dangerous than it actually was.
So it seems like they were building a narrative, maybe even intentionally, to create a sense of panic around OxyContin.
Hmm.
But it wasn't just the DEA, right? The media played a role in amplifying this narrative, too.
Absolutely. The media latched onto these stories, often highlighting anecdotal evidence and presenting it as proof of a widespread epidemic. For example, the Orlando Sentinel ran a series called OxyContin Under Fire, which later had to issue multiple corrections and retractions for misrepresenting data and victim stories.
But even with those corrections, the damage was already done, wasn't it? Those initial stories, even if inaccurate, created a powerful image in the public's mind.
Unfortunately, that's often the case with sensationalized reporting. It taps into our fears and emotions and can be very difficult to counter, even with factual information.
It's a reminder of how much power the media has in shaping public perception and influencing policy decisions. So we have this perfect storm brewing, a genuine pain crisis, the rise of opioid therapy, the DEA looking for a new target, and the media amplifying fears about OxyContin. What happens next? How does the DEA actually go about targeting doctors?
Well, that's where things get really interesting and honestly pretty disturbing. They started using tactics that were traditionally reserved for going after drug traffickers. They created task forces, used asset forfeiture, and even deployed undercover agents posing as patients to try to entrap doctors.
Wait, asset forfeiture? What does that even mean in this context?
Asset forfeiture allows law enforcement to seize property that they believe was used in or obtained through criminal activity. So in this case, they were seizing doctors' assets, like their homes or bank accounts, based on suspicion of illegal prescribing practices.
Wow. That's incredible. It sounds like they were treating doctors like criminals, even before any charges were filed. And you mentioned undercover agents posing as patients.
Yes. Imagine going to see your doctor and not knowing if the person in the waiting room is actually a law enforcement officer trying to build a case against your physician. It's a chilling thought, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
And on top of all that, they had this red flag system to identify what they considered criminal behavior in doctors. But the source says the criteria were often subjective and misleading.
For instance, a doctor having patients from out of state or patients who dressed poorly could be seen as suspicious signs of drug dealing. These red flags created an atmosphere of suspicion and paranoia, making doctors afraid to treat patients in pain for fear of being investigated.
So it sounds like the DEA was essentially forcing doctors to become detectives, constantly on guard for signs of drug abuse in their patients, instead of focusing on providing medical care.
Exactly. And this, of course, had a ripple effect on the doctor-patient relationship, creating a climate of distrust and fear.
It sounds like this shift in the DEA's focus, combined with the media frenzy around OxyContin, really turned the medical field upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors were caught in the crosshairs, forced to choose between treating their patients and protecting themselves from prosecution. But what about the patients themselves? What happened to those who are relying on these medications to manage their pain?
Well, that's a question we'll explore further in our next segment. The impact of this crackdown on patients is a crucial part of this story, and one that I think will leave you with a lot to consider.
So far, we've been talking mostly about the DEA strategy and, you know, how their tactics impacted doctors. But at the heart of this whole issue are the patients, those individuals living with chronic pain. What happened to them when access to pain medication was suddenly restricted?
Well, it's, you know, a really heartbreaking side to this story. The Cato analysis highlights how the DEA's crackdown led to a lot of undertreatment of pain and, you know, caused immense suffering for many Americans.
Yeah, this source mentions a study that found only 1 in 4 pain patients were getting adequate treatment. So imagine living with debilitating pain, knowing there are treatments that could help, but you just can't access them. It must be incredibly frustrating.
Absolutely. And the really sad part is a lot of this stems from the portrayal of anyone taking opioids as a potential addict.
Right.
You know, the DEA's aggressive stance and the media's focus on OxyContin created that image.
Right. And the analysis uses this term pseudo-addicts when talking about these patients. Could you explain what that means?
Sure. It's a term used to describe patients who rely on opioids to function, to manage their pain and live their lives. They're not taking them to get high or engage in destructive behaviors. You know, they're not exhibiting the classic signs of addiction.
But it seems like the DEA didn't necessarily make that distinction. They kind of viewed all opioid use through that same lens.
Right. And because of that, many patients who legitimately needed these medications were treated like criminals. They faced a lot of difficulty finding doctors willing to prescribe opioids, were sometimes subjected to intrusive surveillance.
Wow.
And in some cases, even faced prosecution.
The story of Richard Pei that's mentioned in the source is a really jarring example of this. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison for possessing medication for his own chronic pain. I mean, it seems almost unbelievable that something like that could happen.
Yeah, it's a tragic case. Richard Pei suffered from multiple sclerosis and had experienced severe injuries. He required high doses of painkillers just to function, but his doctor was in another state. And to manage his pain, he'd resorted to filling, you know, photocopies of his prescriptions.
And that's what landed him in trouble with the law.
Exactly. Even though there was no evidence of him selling or distributing the medication, he was convicted of intent to distribute because the amount he possessed exceeded a certain legal limit.
It really highlights how these drug laws, which are meant to protect people, can sometimes have the opposite effect and end up punishing those who need help the most.
It certainly raises some questions about the fairness and effectiveness of those laws in situations like this.
Yeah. And the source also points out that the DEA often used the threat of prosecution to pressure patients into testifying against their doctors. I mean, that's adding another layer of complexity to the situation.
It is. It pitted patients against the very people who were trying to help them manage their pain. And this created a really toxic environment of distrust and fear, which further eroded that doctor-patient relationship, which is so vital in healthcare.
As we kind of delve deeper into this issue, it becomes clear that it's not a simple black and white situation.
Yeah.
I mean, this deep dive is revealing this web of policies, media narratives, and personal stories that are all kind of intertwined.
You're right. It's a very nuanced issue. And the central question that keeps coming up is, are we striking the right balance between preventing drug abuse and ensuring that people have access to the pain relief they need?
Yeah. And it seems like in this case, the focus on enforcement went too far, and there were very real and harmful consequences for patients.
But were there any other voices speaking out against this approach? Did anyone kind of push back against the DEA? Well, there was growing criticism of the DEA's tactics. The source even mentions that the National Association of Attorneys General, representing 30 states, sent a letter to the DEA in 2005. Expressing concerns about their increasingly aggressive approach and the negative impact it was having on legitimate medical practice.
So even law enforcement officials were starting to question the DEA's methods.
Yes. They recognized that this crackdown was creating this chilling effect on doctors, making them afraid to prescribe opioids even when they were medically necessary. And this pushback signaled a growing awareness that something had gone wrong, that the pendulum had swung too far in the direction of enforcement.
This deep dive is painting a picture of a pivotal moment in the history of pain management in America. It really shows how fear and the pressure to get quick results can sometimes lead to policies that have unforeseen and detrimental consequences.
Exactly. And this raises some really important questions that we'll discuss further in our final segment. How do we balance the need to prevent drug abuse with the right of patients to receive adequate pain relief? What lessons can we learn from this chapter in history?
You know, we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive into the DEA's pursuit of pain doctors, and it's a story that really makes you think.
It does. One of the most striking takeaways for me is how this situation, you know, highlights these unintended consequences that can arise even from policies that are designed with good intentions.
Yeah, we saw how the DEA, under pressure to demonstrate progress in the war on drugs, turned their attention to prescription painkillers.
Right. And how that shift, coupled with media hype and these really aggressive tactics, you know, ended up creating this climate of fear and uncertainty that impacted both doctors and patients.
Yeah, doctors worried about being targeted became increasingly reluctant to prescribe opioids even when they were, you know, medically appropriate.
And patients who relied on these medications to manage their chronic pain faced increasing difficulty in accessing the relief they needed.
Right. And the Cato analysis, you know, really emphasizes that this crackdown didn't actually address the underlying causes of drug abuse, such as theft and illegal distribution networks.
Yeah. Instead, it seems like it ended up punishing those who were genuinely trying to manage their pain and the doctors who were trying to help them.
Yeah. It really raises the question of whether the cure might have been worse than the disease in this case.
It certainly does. And this leads us to a very important question that we all need to consider. How do we strike a balance between preventing drug abuse and ensuring that people have access to adequate pain relief?
It's a really complex issue with no easy answers, but this deep dive has given us a lot to think about.
Yeah.
It's really highlighted how important it is to critically evaluate the information we're presented with,
yeah,
especially when it comes to, you know, emotionally charged topics like drug use.
You're absolutely right. We need to be aware of the power of media narratives and how they can shape public perception and ultimately influence policy decisions.
And we also have to remember that in our attempts to control one problem, we may unintentionally create other problems.
Yeah, this case really demonstrates that. So as you move forward, I would encourage you to, you know, reflect on what we've discussed today and think about how you can advocate for policies that address the root causes of drug abuse while also protecting the rights of people in pain to receive the care they deserve.
Well, this deep dive has been a real eye-opener. It's a story that kind of stays with you and hopefully encourages us all to think critically and push for, you know, more humane and effective solutions to these complex problems.
Yeah, thanks for joining us on this journey.
We'll see you next time.